Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we're tackling a pretty huge question, maybe one of the biggest. What actually makes something alive?
Yeah, it sounds simple, but it's incredibly deep.
Right. I mean, you can have these super complex AIs in video games, right? They learn, they adapt, they seem intelligent. But are they alive? Like alive in the same way even a tiny little bacterium is.
Exactly. What's that spark? What's the difference?
Yeah, what's the hidden code, you know?
Yeah.
The rules that separate like a clever program from a living cell.
Well, that distinction, that whole intricate dance of being alive, that's exactly what we're diving into today.
Okay.
We're exploring the chemicals of life. This is really ground zero for anyone starting out in biology. Think of it as digging into the actual source code, the fundamental building blocks that make up every single living thing.
From microbes to us.
Everything.
And for you listening, especially if you're aiming for those medical program admissions, this isn't just, you know, abstract stuff. This is foundational.
Absolutely.
Mastering these basics. It's not just for exams. It's about building this solid mental framework, right? So you can actually understand the really complex stuff later on, like learning the core game mechanics inside out before you try to master the end game strategy.
That's a perfect analogy. You need that foundation.
Yeah.
Because think about it. Every disease you'll learn about, every treatment, every bodily function, it all comes down to the chemistry we're about to unpack.
When things go wrong in the body, it's often chemistry gone wrong.
Precisely. Malfunctioning chemical processes. So this dive is about giving you the toolkit to start understanding those root causes.
Okay, I'm ready. Let's start at the beginning. What exactly is biology?
Well, at its core, the simplest definition is just the study of living things. Pretty straightforward.
But it feels like it's so much more than just that definition implies.
Oh, absolutely. Let's stick with the gaming idea. Imagine life itself is the biggest, most complex, most detailed open world game ever created. Biology, then, is the ultimate game guide. It's the complete lore compendium, the instruction manual, everything. Covers it all from the tiniest pixels, the chemicals we're talking about today, all the way up to the entire game world, the ecosystems, the biosphere.
So it's not just cataloging parts, it's understanding the rules, the interactions, the whole system.
Exactly. The mechanics, the characters, their abilities, the environments, how it all fits together in this massive dynamic simulation.
Got it. So how do we draw that line then between the living players in this game and, say, a really complex rock formation or that AI we mentioned? What's the checklist for being alive?
Ah, yes, the characteristics of life. This is crucial. Living things aren't defined by just one thing. They have this whole set of characteristics like abilities or attributes in a character profile.
And you need all of them?
Generally, yes. To be considered alive, an entity needs to tick all these boxes. It's the universal checklist for being a living unit in this game. Miss one, and, well, it's not quite life as we define it.
Okay, let's go through the list. What's number one?
First up, and maybe the most fundamental, is organization. Living things aren't just, you know, random piles of stuff.
Right.
They're incredibly organized, highly structured. The basic unit, the sort of fundamental building block, is the cell. And this organization scales up. Cells form tissues. Tissues form organs. Organs form complex organisms.
Like building with Legos, but infinitely more complex and self-managing?
Kind of. Or think of a high-end gaming PC, perfectly optimized. Every single component, the CPU, the GPU, the RAM, the code running on it, has a specific role, and they're all interconnected to make the whole thing function smoothly.
Yeah, a messy PC with loose cables isn't going to run well.
Exactly. Or a buggy MMO world where things don't fit together, it crashes. This intricate hierarchy, from cell to organism, is fundamental for medicine. A problem in one tiny part, like a specific type of cell malfunctioning, can throw the whole system off. That's what doctors are often trying to figure out.
Makes sense. Order is key. What's next?
Next is reproduction. The ability to make more of yourself, basically.
Passing on the game code.
Precisely. Producing other individuals of the same species. This is obviously essential for life to continue beyond just one individual. It can be sexual, needing two parents to combine genetic material.
Like breeding Pokemon or pals to get new ones with mixed traits.
Exactly like that. Or it can be asexual, where one organism just makes a copy of itself.
Like cloning a basic unit in an RTS game. Quick and identical.
Perfect analogy. Asexual is like hitting copy-paste for a basic unit. Sexual reproduction is like mixing the stats from two parent units to create a unique offspring, maybe one that's stronger or better adapted. And for medicine, Understanding reproduction is vital for genetics, inheritance patterns of diseases, and even how infections spread as pathogens reproduce.
Okay, organization, reproduction, then things grow, right? Growth and development, are they different?
They are distinct, yeah. We often use them together, but biologically. Growth is essentially a permanent increase in size. More cells or bigger cells, you just get bigger.
Like leveling up your character's basic stats, more health points?
Right. But development is about the changes in shape, form, and function as an organism matures. It's not just getting bigger, it's becoming more complex, gaining new abilities.
Ah, so like when your RPG character evolves or unlocks a whole new skill tree, they don't just get bigger, they change form, get new powers. Like a Pokemon evolving.
Exactly. That captures it perfectly. And in medicine, think about child development milestones, how tissues heal and repair themselves, or even how diseases like cancer involve uncontrolled growth and abnormal development. It all ties back.
And all this growing, developing, reproducing, it needs fuel.
Which brings us to feeding or nutrition.
Yep, gotta have resources. This is simply the consumption of nutrients and energy from the environment. Every living thing needs energy to power its processes and raw materials to build and maintain itself.
Like grabbing power-ups, health potions, or food items in a game. Exactly. They're not just cosmetic. They provide the actual energy, the stamina, the mana, and the building blocks needed to perform actions, survive, repair damage. In humans, diet, metabolism, nutritional deficiencies. These are huge areas in medicine. What you eat directly fuels or fails to fuel these fundamental processes.
Okay, speaking of energy, respiration. Now, this isn't just breathing, is it? It's something deeper happening in the cells.
Much deeper. Breathing is just the start for many animals, getting the oxygen in. Cellular respiration is the key process. It's a chemical breakdown of nutrients like glucose to release energy. And specifically, to release it in the form of ATP adenosine triphosphate.
ATP, the energy currency.
The energy currency, absolutely. Think of ATP as the universal in-game energy points, or mana. It powers everything. Every muscle twitch, every nerve signal, every bit of molecule building, it all runs on ATP.
So no ATP, no actions, like your mana bar hitting zero.
Pretty much. Your character just stands there, helpless. Respiration is the power plant, constantly generating that ATP, keeping your energy bar full, keeping the cell alive and functioning. Understanding this is key to understanding muscle function, brain activity, heart problems. So many things rely on efficient energy production.
Makes sense. If you're doing all these chemical reactions burning fuel, you must generate waste. Excretion.
Spot on. You can't have all that activity without byproducts. Excretion is simply getting rid of metabolic waste products. Things like carbon dioxide from respiration or urea from breaking down proteins.
These are toxic if they burn up.
Highly toxic, yes. They disrupt everything. So the body has systems to remove them. Think of it like clearing out the junk loot from your inventory in a game.
Or defragging your hard drive. Get rid of the clutter so the system runs smoothly.
Exactly. If that waste builds up, it's like getting serious system lag or debuffs that cripple performance. Kidney function, liver detoxification. These are major excretory systems. And when they fail, it's a huge medical emergency.
Okay. How about interacting with the world? Responsiveness or sensitivity?
This is about reacting to the environment. Living things need to be able to detect changes or stimuli, both internally and externally, and then respond appropriately, usually in a way that helps them survive.
Like your game character dodging an incoming attack, or noticing a flashing item and grabbing it.
Perfect examples. It's that instant feedback loop. See danger, react. See opportunity, react. In us, it's our nervous system, our reflexes catching us when we trip, our immune system responding to an infection. It's all about sensing and responding appropriately to survive.
Then there's movement. Seems simple, but I guess it's more than just walking around.
Oh, yeah. Biologically, movement refers to active processes that require energy and originate within cells. It includes locomotion, the whole organism moving, like us walking or bacterium swimming.
Like your character running across the map.
Yeah.
Costs stamina, right?
Right, costs energy. But it also includes movement of parts of an organism, like plants turning leaves to the sun, or your heart beating, or even movement inside cells, like tiny components being transported along molecular tracks.
Like background processes keeping the game engine running smoothly.
That's a great way to put it. It's all energy-dependent movement, essential for finding food, escaping danger, circulating nutrients, you name it. Related to muscles, skeletons, circulation, cell biology.
Okay, this next one feels huge, especially for medicine. homeostasis.
Absolutely monumental. If there's one concept that underpins all of physiology, it might be homeostasis. It's the ability of an organism to maintain a relatively constant internal environment despite whatever chaos is happening outside.
Keeping things stable inside, like temperature, blood sugar.
Exactly. Body temperature, pH levels, water balance, blood pressure, all kept within very narrow optimal ranges. Think of it as the game's auto balance system. Your health drops, maybe regeneration kicks in automatically to bring it back up.
Or you use an antidote when poisoned to counteract the effect and restore balance.
Precisely. It's about keeping your core character stats within the green zone for peak performance. So much of medicine is about understanding when homeostasis fails, like in diabetes with blood sugar, or heat stroke with temperature, and figuring out how to help the body restore that balance. Life really depends on it.
And the last one on the list, a really big picture concept, evolution.
Evolution. This is about change over long periods, over generations. It's the ability of populations of living things to gradually change, adapt, and diversify into new forms of life.
So not about an individual changing, but the whole species over time.
Exactly. Think about how game developers release patches or updates that change the meta. Certain strategies or character builds become more effective because they're better suited to the new rules or environment. That's kind of like natural selection driving evolution.
Or how a whole game franchise changes over decades. The graphics, the mechanics evolve, the successful ideas carry forward.
Yeah, that works too. Understanding evolution is crucial for things like antibiotic resistance bacteria evolving to beat our drugs, or understanding the origins of genetic diseases, or how populations adapt to climate change. It's the grand narrative connecting all life.
Wow. Okay, that's quite a list. Organization, reproduction, growth and development, feeding, respiration, excretion, responsiveness, movement, homeostasis, and evolution. That's a lot to keep track of.
It is. But it defines what makes life so unique and complex.
So with all that going on, what do biologists actually do? How do they study this incredibly complex game?
Well, biologists study life at every single level you can imagine, from the atoms and molecules we're about to get into, right up to whole ecosystems, lab work, field work, computer modeling. It's incredibly diverse. But the common thread is the approach. The scientific method.
Right, the scientific method. It always sounded a bit dry in school, but thinking about it like a quest.
It really is. It's a structured way of asking questions and finding reliable answers. It starts with making observations and taking measurements. You notice something interesting or puzzling in the game world.
But like, why does this monster only appear at night?
Exactly. That leads to asking questions and defining the problem. Then you formulate a hypothesis, which is basically just a testable prediction or explanation.
My hypothesis, the monster is nocturnal because it's sensitive to sunlight.
Good one. Then you state predictions based on that. If my hypothesis is true, then the monster should always avoid sunlight and be active in darkness.
And then the key part, testing it.
Right. You test the hypothesis, usually with a controlled experiment. The controlled part is super important.
Yeah.
You try to change only one thing at a time, the variable you're interested in, and keep everything else the same.
So I'd expose the monster to different light levels, but keep its food, temperature, everything else constant.
Exactly. Mm. So you can be sure it's the light causing the effect, not something else. Then you interpret the results objectively. Look at the data. Did it avoid light? Did it not? No wishful thinking.
And finally, you draw conclusions. Does the evidence support my hypothesis? Maybe I need to modify it, or maybe reject it entirely.
Precisely. You accept, modify, or reject. And this whole process, this quest for evidence, isn't just for scientists and labs. Medical research, clinical trials for new drugs, even a doctor diagnosing a patient, they all use elements of this systematic evidence-based thinking. It's about figuring things out reliably.
Okay, so we've got the big picture of life and how we study it. Now let's zoom way in. Right down to the fundamental building blocks, the chemicals of life, elements.
We're going down to the absolute bedrock now. An element is basically a pure substance that you just can't break down into anything simpler by normal chemical means.
Like the primary resources in a crafting game.
What?
Wood, stone, iron, ore. You can't break wood down into something simpler than wood using your basic tools.
Exactly. They are the fundamental components. And it's kind of mind-blowing, but everything on Earth, living or not, is built from just 92 naturally occurring elements. That's the entire palette we have to work with.
92 basic ingredients for everything. Wow.
Yeah.
And the smallest possible piece of an element is an atom, right?
Spot on. An atom is the smallest unit of an element that still has all the chemical properties of that element. If iron ore is the element, One single atom is the tiniest possible speck you can have that's still recognizably iron.
It's the indivisible unit of that resource.
Precisely. And here's the kicker for biology. The way entire organisms look and function ultimately depends on the structure and interactions of the atoms they're made of. It's all built from the atom up. Micro-level stuff dictates macro-level life.
So what's inside the atom itself? The structure of the atom?
Okay, think small. Really small. At the center of almost every atom, there's the nucleus. It's tiny but dense. Inside the nucleus are usually two types of particles. Protons, which have a positive plus electrical charge, and neutrons, which have no charge.
Yeah.
Or neutral.
Protons positive, neutrons neutral. Got it.
Then whizzing around the nucleus in specific regions called electron shells or energy levels are the electrons. These have a negative electrical charge.
So positive nucleus, negative electrons orbiting, like a mini solar system.
That's a common analogy. The nucleus is the heavy sun in the middle, and the electrons are the superfast planets in specific orbits or shells. Quick side note, hydrogen is a bit special. Its nucleus is usually just one proton, no neutrons.
Okay. And these particles determine the atom's properties.
Absolutely. The number of protons is what defines the element. It's like the atom's unique ID number. Change the proton number, you change the element entirely. The electrons, especially the ones in the outermost shell, are the key players in how atoms interact and form bonds with each other. They determine the chemistry.
And atoms aren't always neutral, are they? They can become ions.
Right. An ion is just an atom that's gained or lost electrons, giving it an overall electrical charge. See, in a neutral atom, the number of positive protons exactly balances the number of negative electrons. Zero net charge.
But if it loses an electron...
If it loses a negative electron, it has more protons than electrons, so it becomes positively charged, a positive ion.
And if it gains an electron?
Gains an extra negative charge, so it becomes negatively charged, a negative ion. Think of it like a game resource getting an electrical enchantment, or debuff.
So a neutral piece of iron ore gains an electricity debuff an electron and becomes a negative ion, changing how it reacts.
Exactly. And this is hugely important in the body. Ions like sodium, potassium, calcium, their movement creates nerve impulses, makes muscles contract, keeps fluids balanced. Ion imbalances are behind a lot of medical issues, heart problems, nerve problems. They're tiny, but critical, the literal sparks of life.
So with 92 elements, how do we keep track? The periodic table must be like the ultimate cheat sheet.
It totally is. The periodic table is the master crafting recipe book or item database. Mm-hmm. It organizes all the elements based on their atomic number, which remember is just the number of protons.
Unique for each element.
Unique for each. And the magic is how it's arranged. Elements in the same vertical column, called a group, tend to have similar chemical properties. They behave in similar ways.
So elements in the same column are like different tiers of the same resource family in a game, like different types of metal ore that can all be smelted.
That's a great way to think about it. It helps predict how elements will react and combine, which is fundamental for chemistry and biology.
Now, the outline mentioned tracers, but you said the source didn't detail them.
Yeah, that's right. The term tracers appeared in the outline we were given, but the actual source material didn't provide any explanation or context for them in this chapter, so we can't really elaborate based on the provided info.
Okay, noted. Something maybe for future exploration if we get sources on it. So let's move on to how these atoms actually link up. Right, so atoms aren't usually loners. They like to team up, right? Why is that? Why the bonding?
It comes down to stability. Most isolated atoms are actually kind of, well, unstable or incomplete. Their outermost electron shell usually isn't full.
Like a character build that isn't quite optimized, feels weak on its own.
Exactly. They're like lone wolf players, often vulnerable. To become more stable, more complete, they form chemical bonds with other atoms. It's like joining a guild or a team.
And they do that by messing with their electron.
Precisely. They achieve stability, usually by getting a full outer electron shell, by either sharing or transferring electrons with other atoms. That interaction is the chemical bond. It's the glue holding matter together.
And there are different ways they team up, different types of chemical bonding.
Yep. The source highlights two main types. First, covalent bonding. This is super common in the molecules of life, like proteins and DNA. In covalent bonds, atoms share electrons.
Like players pooling resources or sharing a buff that helps both.
Exactly. Both atoms get joint custody of the shared electrons, creating a strong, stable link. Then there's ionic bonding. Here, it's not sharing, it's a transfer.
Like trading items.
Yeah, one atom literally gives one or more electrons to another atom. The one that loses electrons becomes a positive ion. The one that gains electrons becomes a negative ion.
And opposites attract.
Bingo.
Yeah.
The positive and negative ions are then strongly attracted to each other, like magnets. That attraction is the ionic bond. Think table salt, sodium chloride, that's an ionic compound. Both bond types are essential for building life structures.
So when atoms bond, they form molecules and compounds. Okay, clarify this for me again. What's the difference? It always trips people up.
It does. Let's break it down. A molecule is the general term. It's just two or more atoms joined together by chemical bonds. Simple as that.
Can they be the same type of atom?
Yes. For example, the oxygen gas we breathe is R2. That's two oxygen atoms bonded together. That's a molecule. Water, H2O, with two hydrogen atoms and one oxygen atom, is also a molecule.
Okay, so any team of two or more atoms is a molecule, like a team of two archers, O2, or a team with an archer and a tank, H2O.
Perfect. Now, a compound is a specific type of molecule. To be a compound, the molecule must contain atoms of at least two different elements.
Ah, okay. So H2O is a compound because it has hydrogen, AD, oxygen.
Correct. But O2 is not a compound because it only contains oxygen atoms, just one element.
So the rule is, all compounds are molecules, but not all molecules are compounds.
You got it. A compound team has to have different classes of players. O2 is a molecule team, but not a compound team. H2O is both.
And we write these down using a chemical formula.
Yep. The chemical formula is like the team roster or the recipe card. It tells you exactly which atoms are in the molecule and how many of each. Like CH4 for methane, one carbon, four hydrogens. That precise formula defines the substance. Change it even slightly and you get something completely different.
Okay. Elements, atoms, molecules. Let's talk about one specific molecule that's just absolutely essential for life as we know it. Water. H2O. Seems simple, but it's kind of a superhero molecule, isn't it?
It really is. Calling it the universal solvent barely scratches the surface. Water has this suite of unique properties that are just perfectly tuned for supporting life. It's the ultimate utility potion, the environmental enabler in the game of life.
Without it, the game just wouldn't work. At least not our version of it.
Not even close.
So let's break down these amazing properties. First off, the fact that it's liquid at room temperature seems basic, but why is it so important?
It's fundamental. Being liquid over a wide temperature range provides the fluid medium inside our cells where all the chemistry happens. Imagine trying to have reactions happen in a solid block of ice.
Wouldn't work very well, like a fluid battleground inside the cell for all the chemical skirmishes.
Exactly. And it also creates the aquatic environments, oceans, lakes, rivers, where so much life exists.
And it has that weird skin on top high surface tension?
Right. Water molecules stick to each other very strongly, especially at the surface where they meet air. This creates a kind of invisible, elastic film.
Allowing things like pond skaters to walk on water, like a special game mechanic.
Precisely. Like an invisible force field they can glide across. It's all down to the hydrogen bonds between water molecules.
Okay, and this is a weird one. Ice floats on water. Most solids sink in their liquids.
This is incredibly unusual and incredibly important. Because ice is less dense than liquid water, it forms on the surface of lakes and ponds in winter.
Acting like a blanket.
Exactly. That layer of ice insulates the water underneath, preventing it from freezing solid. This allows fish and other aquatic life to survive the winter below. It's like a natural insulation spell protecting the inhabitants. If ice sank, lakes would freeze from the bottom up, killing almost everything.
Wow. Okay, the big one. Universal solvent.
Yeah. Water is amazing at dissolving other substances, especially polar or ionic ones. More things dissolve in water than any other common liquid. Why is this vital? Because most chemical reactions in our cells happen in water in aqueous solution.
It's the ultimate crafting fluid, where all the ingredients can mix and react.
Perfect analogy. And it's also the primary transport medium. Blood plasma is mostly water, carrying nutrients, hormones, waste products. It's the delivery system for the whole body. Crucial for understanding how drugs work, how nutrients get absorbed, everything.
And it's wetness that relates to adhesion and capillarity.
Right. Wetness implies adhesion water molecules sticking to other surfaces, like glass or the inside of plant vessels. Combine that with water sticking to itself, cohesion, and its low viscosity, and you get capillarity.
That's water moving upwards in narrow tubes against gravity.
Yep, like water climbing up inside a thin straw, or, more importantly, climbing up the narrow xylem tubes in a plant stem, all the way to the leaves. It's like water having a sticky, gravity-defying climb ability, essential for tall trees.
And it also has high tensile strength for a liquid.
It sounds odd, but yes, because the water molecules hold onto each other so strongly, cohesion again, thanks to hydrogen bonds, a continuous column of water resists being pulled apart.
Like a liquid rope.
Pretty much. This allows that column of water in the xylem to be pulled all the way up a 100-foot tree during transpiration without the column breaking. Amazing stuff.
It also flows easily, low viscosity.
Yes, it's not thick and syrupy like honey. It flows freely. This makes it great for transport blood flows easily through tiny capillaries. And it makes watery solutions good lubricants.
Like mucus in your throat, helping food go down. Or fluid in your joints.
Exactly. Reduces friction, allows smooth movement. A slippery lubricant spell for biological systems.
And it's denser than air. Obvious, but biologically useful.
Definitely. Its density provides buoyancy, which supports huge aquatic animals like whales, letting them reach sizes impossible on land. It also helps disperse things like seeds, coconuts, or larvae over long distances via currents.
Water isn't just passive either. It takes part in many chemical reactions.
Crucial point. It's not just the stage. It's often an actor. It's a key reactant in photosynthesis. Plants use water and CO2 to make sugar using sunlight.
The ultimate solar power generation fuel.
Right. And it's used in hydrolysis reactions during digestion, where water molecules are used to break down large food molecules, like proteins or starches, into smaller units. It's an active ingredient in many essential crafting recipes.
Its colorless and transparent nature matters too, doesn't it? Especially underwater.
Hugely important for aquatic ecosystems, because sunlight can penetrate through clear water. Underwater plants and algae can perform photosynthesis, forming the base of the food web. It's like a clear window, allowing the solar farms below to function.
And it's difficult to compress. How is that useful?
It means water can act as a structural support. Think of earthworms. They don't have bones. They have a sort of hydrostatic skeleton. The pressure of the water inside their bodies gives them shape and allows them to move.
And plants use it too. Turgor pressure.
Exactly. When plant cells are full of water, they become stiff and rigid, turgid. That's what keeps non-woody plants upright. Water acts like an incompressible force field or a liquid skeleton.
Okay, now the temperature stuff. Very high specific heat capacity. What does that mean?
It means water can absorb a lot of heat energy without its own temperature changing very much. And it also has to lose a lot of heat to cool down.
So it resists temperature changes, like a buffer.
Precisely. It acts like a massive heat sink or a temperature stabilization field. This keeps the temperature inside organisms relatively stable, even if the outside temperature fluctuates wildly. It also keeps oceans and large lakes from experiencing extreme temperature swings, vital for life.
And high latent heat of vaporization, that's about evaporation.
Yes. It takes a surprisingly large amount of heat energy to turn liquid water into water vapor, gas. When water evaporates from a surface, it takes that heat with it, cooling the surface down.
Like sweating, evaporation cools us off.
Exactly. It's the body's natural evaporative cooling spell. Plants do it too, through transpiration. It's a very effective way to shed excess heat.
And similarly, high latent heat of fusion, about freezing.
Right. This means a lot of heat has to be removed from water to make it freeze into ice. This makes cells and aquatic environments slow to freeze when the temperature drops below freezing. It provides freeze resistance, preventing sudden damaging ice formation.
One last water property.
Yeah.
It combines with many organic molecules. Hydrated molecules.
Yeah, many of the complex organic molecules in our cells exist in a hydrated state, meaning water molecules are closely associated with them, often bound to their surface. This hydration is often essential for the molecule's correct shape and function.
Like some game items needing water infusion to work properly, dehydrate them and they break or stop working.
That's a good way to think about it. Removing that associated water can drastically change the properties of proteins or other vital molecules. It just shows how deeply integrated water is with everything else.
Water truly is extraordinary. Okay, quickly then, while we're on water and mixing things, the pH of solutions.
Right, pH is critical because so many biological reactions, especially those involving enzymes, are very sensitive to acidity or alkalinity. First, some basics. A solution is a uniform mixture, like salt dissolves in water. Your perfectly blended potion.
Okay.
The solvent is the main liquid doing the dissolving, usually water in biology. The potion base. The solute is the stuff being dissolved, the salt, the sugar, the potion ingredients.
And pH measures?
pH measures how acidic or basic alkaline the solution is. It's a scale, usually 0 to 14. Low pH means acidic, high pH means basic, and 7 is neutral. It's basically measuring the concentration of hydrogen ions.
Like the strength or type of the potion acid damage or alkaline healing?
Kind of. And maintaining the right pH at different parts of the body, blood around 7.4, stomach very acidic, is absolutely vital. This is hardcore homeostasis. If blood pH goes even slightly off acidosis or alkalosis, it's a medical emergency because proteins, especially enzymes, stop working correctly.
Okay, we've got the elements, the solvent. Now for the big, complex molecules built from these basics, the major biomolecules. Let's start with lipids, fats, oils.
Lipids, a really diverse group, the defining feature. They are generally insoluble in water, hydrophobic or water-fearing. But they dissolve well in other lipids or organic solvents.
Like oils and fats don't mix with water, so they're good for making barriers.
Exactly. Perfect for cell membranes, separating watery insides from watery outsides. Think of them as greasy, often energy-dense power-ups, or essential protective coatings and boundaries in the game of life.
The most common type we hear about are triglycerides, true fats, and oils.
Right. These are the main energy storage lipids. They're built from two types of smaller molecules.
Yeah.
One molecule of glycerol and three molecules of fatty acids.
Glycerol is like the backbone.
It is. A small alcohol molecule. And the fatty acids are long chains, mostly carbon and hydrogen atoms, ending in a carboxyl group, COOH, which makes them acidic. They attach to the glycerol via ester bonds formed in a condensation reaction where water is released.
So three fatty acid chains hanging off of glycerol, like the character's long-term energy reserves, packed fuel.
Excellent analogy. Very energy dense, much more so than carbohydrates.
Now, saturated versus unsaturated fatty acids. This comes up all the time in health discussions. What's the difference at the molecular level?
It's all about the bonds and those long hydrocarbon chains of the fatty acids. Saturated means the chain has only single bonds between carbon atoms. It's saturated with hydrogen atoms.
Makes the chain straight.
Pretty much straight and flexible. This allows them to pack together very tightly. Think straight Lego bricks stacking neatly. That's why saturated fats, like butter, lard, tend to be solid at room temperature.
And unsaturated.
Unsaturated fatty acids have one or more double bonds between carbons in the chain. Monounsaturated means one double bond. Polyunsaturated means two or more. These double bonds create kinks or bends in the chain.
Like kinked Lego bricks. They don't stack neatly.
Exactly. Those kinks prevent the fatty acids from packing closely together. This makes triglycerides with lots of unsaturated fatty acids liquid at room temperature. We call them oils, like olive oil, vegetable oil. This difference in structure affects how they're processed by the body.
Okay. Now, arguably the star lipid player, phospholipids, the cell membrane builders.
Absolutely crucial.
Yeah.
Phospholipids form the fundamental structure of all cell membranes. They're similar to triglycerides, but with a key difference. They have a glycerol backbone, two fatty acid tails.
But instead of a third fatty acid.
Instead of a third fatty acid, the glycerol is attached to a negatively charged phosphate group. This phosphate group is often linked to another small polar group as well.
So it has two distinct ends.
Yes. This makes phospholipids amphipathic. The fatty acid tails are nonpolar and hydrophobic, water-fearing. But the phosphate group head is polar and hydrophilic, water-loving.
A dual-natured molecule, like an amphibious unit in a game.
Perfect. One end loves water, the other hates it. This is ideal for making membranes. They spontaneously arrange themselves in a bilayer in a water. Heads facing the water inside and outside the cell, tails tucked away in the middle, creating that barrier.
The protective energy shield around the cell base. Understanding this must be key for medicine, right? How things get into cells.
Absolutely critical. How drugs cross membranes, how nutrients are absorbed, how nerve cells transmit signals.
Yeah.
It all involves the phospholipid bilayer.
Okay, moving from lipids to the real workhorses, proteins. They seem to do everything.
They pretty much do. Proteins are incredibly versatile. They're polymers, meaning long chains made of repeating smaller units. In this case, the units are amino acids.
So a protein is a long chain, a polypeptide chain of amino acids linked together.
Exactly. Linked by strong covalent bonds called peptide bonds. Think of proteins as the complex machines, or the specialized worker units of the cell. And amino acids are the basic Lego bricks or modular components used to build all these different machines.
What does an amino acid itself look like? What are its parts?
Every amino acid has the same basic structure. There's a central carbon atom called the alpha carbon. Attached to it are four things: a hydrogen atom, an acidic carboxyl group, -COH, a basic amino group, -NH2, and then the important part.
The part that makes each one different.
Exactly. The side chain, often called the R group. There are 20 standard amino acids commonly found in proteins, and each one has a unique R group.
And these R groups have different properties. Size, charge.
All sorts of properties. Some are small, some are bulky, some are hydrophobic, some hydrophilic, some are acidic, negatively charged, some basic, positively charged. This variety in the R groups is what gives proteins their incredible diversity of shapes and functions. They're the different types of Lego bricks, each with special features.
So it's not just a random chain. Proteins fold up into specific 3D shapes. How does that happen? Let's talk protein structure.
This folding is absolutely critical. A protein shape determines its function. We talk about four levels of structure. Level one is primary structure.
That's just the sequence, the order of the amino acids.
Yep. The linear sequence of amino acids linked by peptide bonds, like the exact blueprint or the specific order you snap your Lego bricks together. This sequence dictates everything else. Even one wrong amino acid can sometimes cause a major disease, like sickle cell anemia.
Okay, sequence first, then.
Then comes secondary structure. Parts of the polypeptide chain start to fold or coil into regular, repeating patterns. This happens because of hydrogen bonds forming between atoms in the backbone of the chain, not the R groups.
What kind of patterns?
The two most common are the alpha helix, which is like a spiral staircase or a coil, and the beta pleated sheet, which looks like a folded fan or accordion pleats. These are like the first stages of assembly, forming stable structural motifs.
So the chain starts folding locally into spirals and sheets. What's next? The overall 3D shape.
Exactly. That's tertiary structure. This is the final, complex, three-dimensional shape of a single polypeptide chain. It results from all sorts of interactions between the R groups, hydrophobic interactions pushing watery parts away, hydrogen bonds, ionic bonds between charged R groups, strong covalent disulfide bridges between specific sulfur-containing amino acids.
So the R groups interacting cause the whole chain, with its helices and sheets, to fold up into a specific blob or shape.
Blob is a bit casual, but yes. It folds into a precise, functional shape. This is when it becomes a working tool or machine. We often classify tertiary structures into two broad types. Fibrous proteins, which are long and rope-like, often structural, like collagen or keratin, think structural beams or cables. And globular proteins, which are more compact, spherical, and usually have active roles like enzymes or antibodies, think mini engines or active components.
And some proteins are even more complex, made of multiple chains.
Yes, that's the final level. Quaternary structure. This only applies to proteins that are made up of more than one polypeptide chain, each chain called a subunit. It describes how these multiple subunits fit together to form the final functional protein complex.
Like multiple machines linking up to form a super machine or a squad.
Great analogy. Hemoglobin, which carries oxygen and blood, is a classic example. It's made of four separate polypeptide subunits working together. Not all proteins have quaternary structure, only those made of multiple chains.
Amazing complexity. So given these structures, what are the main types of protein functions? You said they do almost everything.
The list is huge. We have enzymes like amylase digesting starch. These are biological catalysts, speeding up reactions immensely, like catalyst units or crafting speed buffs.
It's crucial.
Structural proteins, collagen and skin, keratin and hair, provide support, shape, strength. The building materials or support beams. Signal proteins, like the hormone insulin, carry messages between cells. Messenger units. Contractile proteins, actin and myosin in muscle, responsible for movement. Movement units.
Muscles, yeah.
Storage proteins, albumin and egg white, store nutrients, especially amino acids. Resource storage units. Defensive proteins, antibodies, protect against disease. Defense units targeting invaders.
Immune system.
And transport proteins, like hemoglobin carrying oxygen, or proteins in cell membranes moving substances across, move molecules around. Logistics units. Honestly, understanding protein structure and function is central to nearly all of medicine. Drug design often targets specific proteins. Many diseases involve protein malfunction. Nutrition impacts protein building. It's everywhere.
Okay. Proteins are the workers. What about the instructions, the blueprint? That's nucleotides and nucleic acids, right? DNA and RNA.
Exactly. If proteins are the machines, nucleic acids are the information storage and management system. The fundamental unit here is the nucleotide.
Another building block molecule. What are its parts?
Each nucleotide has three components. First, a nitrogen-containing organic base, often just called a nitrogenous base. These are the actual letters of the genetic code. There are five main types falling into two families. Purines, double ring structure, adenine A, guanine G, and pyrimidines, single ring structure, cytosine C, thymine T, and uracil U.
A, G, C, T, U. the code letters.
Right. Second part. A 5-carbon sugar, a pentose. This sugar is slightly different in DNA, deoxyribose, versus RNA. Processing. Think of it as the power source or part of the backbone.
Okay, and the third part.
One or more phosphate groups. These are negatively charged and link the nucleotides together to form long chains. They're the connectors. So base plus sugar plus phosphate nucleotide, like a data chip with its database, power, sugar, and connector, phosphate.
And these nucleotides link up to form the big one, deoxyribonucleic acid, DNA, the master blueprint.
The master blueprint indeed. The ultimate game code containing instructions for almost everything the organism does. In DNA, nucleotides are linked by strong phosphodiester bonds between the sugar of one nucleotide and the phosphate of the next, forming a long polynucleotide chain. This creates the sugar-phosphate backbone.
And DNA is usually double-stranded.
Yes, the famous double helix. It consists of 2 polynucleotide strands twisted around each other like a spiral staircase or a twisted ladder.
Okay, 2 strands. How are they connected? And how are they arranged?
Great questions. First, the strands run in opposite directions. They're anti-parallel. One runs 5 to 3 prime, the other runs 3 to 5 fence, like 2 lanes of traffic going opposite ways. This is important for how the code is read and copied.
Okay, anti-parallel. And they're linked across the middle.
Yes. The 2 strands are held together by hydrogen bonds forming between the bases. And this pairing is very specific. It's called complementary base pairing. Adenine A on one strand always pairs with thymine T on the other strand, using 2 hydrogen bonds. Guanine G always pairs with cytosine C, using 3 hydrogen bonds.
A with T, G with C, always, like puzzle pieces that only fit one way.
Exactly. A purine A or G always pairs with a pyrimidine, T or C. These hydrogen bonds are weaker than the covalent bonds in the backbone, which is important because the strands need to separate temporarily for copying and reading the code. But together, millions of them make the double helix stable.
So this structure holds the code for inheritance, for building proteins, influencing everything.
Everything. Physical traits, biochemical processes, the molecule of life, the core operating system.
So if DNA is the master blueprint stored safely in the nucleus in eukaryotes, what about ribonucleic acid, RNA? Is it the working copy, the messenger?
That's a great way to put it. RNA molecules are the worker units, the data readers and builders that interpret the DNA blueprint and carry out its instructions, mainly for making proteins.
How is RNA different from DNA?
3 key differences to remember. First, structure. DNA is usually double-stranded. RNA is typically single-stranded. Second, sugar. DNA has deoxyribose sugar. RNA has ribose sugar, just a tiny difference, one less oxygen atom in deoxyribose. Third, bases. RNA uses uracil U instead of thymine T, so an RNA adenine A pairs with uracil. U still pairs with C.
Single strand, ribose, sugar, uracil instead of thymine.
Got it. And there are different kinds of RNA doing different jobs.
Yep. 3 main types involved in protein synthesis. Messenger RNA, mRNA. This is the actual photocopy or transcript of a gene from the DNA. It carries the protein building instructions from the DNA in the nucleus out to the ribosomes in the cytoplasm.
The messenger delivering the blueprint copy. Exactly. Ribosomal RNA, or RNA. This type of RNA, along with proteins, forms the structure of ribosomes, the cellular factories where proteins are actually assembled. RNA is the assembly line machinery itself.
Okay.
And the third type, transfer RNA, tRNA. These are relatively small RNA molecules folded to a specific shape, like a clover leaf. Their job is to act as adapters. One end of the tRNA reads the code on the mRNA, 3 bases at a time, called a codon, and the other end carries the specific amino acid that corresponds to that code.
So they're the delivery drones, reading the mRNA instructions and bringing the right amino acid Lego brick to the ribosome factory.
Perfect. tRNA ensures the amino acids are added in the correct sequence dictated by the mRNA, which was copied from the DNA. So DNA holds the master plan, mRNA carries the working copy, RNA builds the factory, and tRNA brings the parts. It's an incredibly elegant system, and understanding it is fundamental for genetics, genetic diseases, viral infections. Many viruses like flu and HIV use RNA and developing new medicines. #, #outromurba.
Wow. Okay, that was a seriously deep dive. We went from asking, what is life? Right down to the atoms, the magic of water, the fats, the protein machines, and the DNA blueprint itself.
We covered a lot of ground. From basic elements right up to these incredibly complex macromolecules, it really is like learning the foundational code, the assembly language of the biological world.
And for anyone listening who's heading towards medicine, you can really see how this isn't just, you know, background info. This is the background.
Absolutely. It's the bedrock. Human physiology, how diseases work, pathology, how drugs interact with the body, pharmacology.
Mm-hmm.
It all comes back to these chemical principles, these molecular interactions, every single time.
It's amazing how precise it all is, like this incredibly complex, perfectly balanced game engine, every component, every interaction just right.
It really is awe-inspiring when you think about the detail.
Which leads to a final thought, I guess. If it's that intricate, that interconnected, what happens when just one tiny thing goes wrong? One little typo in the DNA code? One protein that doesn't fold quite right? How does that ripple through the whole system?
That's the core question of pathology, isn't it? How do these tiny errors cause major problems?
Yeah. And how can a future doctor, maybe you, listening right now, learn not just to see the resulting problem, but to understand the root cause, to figure out how to debug that biological code and help restore that intricate balance? That's the challenge.
That's the challenge and the incredible opportunity of medicine. Understanding this foundation is the first step on that journey.